The New Architects. The political power of design has long been obvious to urban planners. If you take the Wantagh State Parkway from Westbury to Jones Beach on Long Island, at intervals you'll pass under several low, vine-covered overpasses. Some of them have as little as 9 feet of clearance. Trucks aren't allowed on the parkway. They wouldn't fit. This may seem like a design oversight, but it's not. There are about 200 of these low bridges, part of the grand design for the New York region pioneered by Robert Moses. Moses was a master dealmaker, a friend of the great politicians of the time, and an unabashed elitist. According to his biographer, Robert A. Caro, Moses's vision for Jones Beach was an island getaway for middle-class white families. He included the low bridges to make it harder for low-income and mostly black New Yorkers to get to the beach, as public buses, the most common form of transport for inner-city residents, couldn't clear the overpasses. The passage in Caro's The Power Broker, describing this logic, caught the eye of Langdon Winner, a Rolling Stone reporter, musician, professor, and philosopher of technology. In a pivotal 1980 article titled, Do Artifacts Have Politics?, Winner considered how Moses's monumental structures of concrete and steel embody a systematic social inequality, a way of engineering relationships among people that, after a time, became just another part of the landscape. On the face of it, a bridge is just a bridge. But often, as Winner points out, architectural and design decisions are underpinned by politics as much as aesthetics. Like goldfish that grow only large enough for the tank they're in, we're contextual beings. How we behave is dictated in part by the shape of our environments. Put a playground in a park, and you encourage one kind of use. Build a memorial, and you encourage another. As we spend more of our time in cyberspace, and less of our time in what geeks sometimes call meat space or the offline world, Moses's bridges are worth keeping in mind. The algorithms of Google and Facebook may not be made of steel and concrete, but they regulate our behavior just as effectively. That's what Larry Lessig, a law professor and one of the early theorists of cyberspace, meant when he famously wrote that code is law. If code is law, software engineers and geeks are the ones who get to write it. And it's a funny kind of law, created without any judicial system or legislators and enforced nearly perfectly and instantly. Even with anti-vandalism laws on the books, in the physical world you can still throw a rock through the window of a store you don't like. You might even get away with it. But if vandalism isn't part of the design of an online world, it's simply impossible. Try to throw a rock through a virtual storefront, and you just get an error. Back in 1980, Winner wrote, "Consciously or unconsciously, deliberately or inadvertently, societies choose structures for technologies that influence how people are going to work, communicate, travel, consume, and so forth over a very long time." This isn't to say that today's designers have malevolent impulses, of course, or even that they're always explicitly trying to shape society in certain ways. It's just to say that they can. In fact, they can't help but shape the worlds they build. To paraphrase Spider-Man creator Stan Lee, with great power comes great responsibility. But the programmers who brought us the internet and now the filter bubble aren't always game to take on that responsibility. The Hacker Jargon File, an online repository of geek culture, puts it this way. Hackers are far more likely than most non-hackers to either A. be aggressively apolitical, or B. entertain peculiar or idiosyncratic political ideas. Too often, the executives of Facebook, Google, and other socially important companies play it coy. They're social revolutionaries when it suits them, and neutral, amoral businessmen when it doesn't. And both approaches fall short in important ways. Playing it coy. When I first called Google's PR department, I explained that I wanted to know how Google thought about its enormous curatorial power. What was the code of ethics, I asked, that Google uses to determine what to show to whom. The public affairs manager on the other end of the phone sounded confused. "You mean privacy?" "No," I said. "I wanted to know how Google thought about its editorial power." "Oh," he replied, "we're just trying to give people the most relevant information." Indeed, he seemed to imply no ethics were involved or required. I persisted. If a 9/11 conspiracy theorist searches for 9/11, was it Google's job to show him the Popular Mechanics article that debunks his theory or the movie that supports it? Which was more relevant? "I see what you're getting at," he said. "It's an interesting question." But I never got a clear answer. Much of the time, as the jargon file entry claims, engineers resist the idea that their work has moral or political consequences at all. Many engineers see themselves as interested in efficiency and design, in building cool stuff rather than messy ideological disputes and inchoate values. And it's true that if political consequences of, say, a somewhat faster video rendering engine exist, they're pretty obscure. But at times, this attitude can verge on a guns don't kill people, people do mentality, a willful blindness to how their design decisions affect the daily lives of millions. That Facebook's button is named like prioritizes some kinds of information over others. That Google has moved from PageRank, which is designed to show the societal consensus result, to a mix of PageRank and personalization represents a shift in how Google understands relevance and meaning. This amorality would be par for the corporate course if it didn't coincide with sweeping, world-changing rhetoric from the same people and entities. Google's mission to organize the world's information and make it accessible to everyone carries a clear moral and even political connotation, a democratic redistribution of knowledge from closed-door elites to the people. Apple's devices are marketed with the rhetoric of social change and the promise that they'll revolutionize not only your life, but our society as well. The famous Super Bowl ad announcing the release of the Macintosh computer ends by declaring that 1984 won't be like 1984. Facebook describes itself as a social utility, as if it's a 21st century phone company. But when users protest Facebook's constantly shifting and eroding privacy policy, Zuckerberg often shrugs it off with the caveat emptor posture that if you don't want to use Facebook, you don't have to. It's hard to imagine a major phone company getting away with saying, "We're going to publish your phone conversations for anyone to hear, and if you don't like it, just don't use the phone." Google tends to be more explicitly moral in its public aspirations. Its motto is, "Don't be evil," while Facebook's unofficial motto is, "Don't be lame." Nevertheless, Google's founders also sometimes play a get-out-of-jail-free card. "Some say Google is God. Others say Google is Satan," says Sergey Brin. "But if they think Google is too powerful, remember that with search engines, unlike other companies, all it takes is a single click to go to another search engine. People come to Google because they choose to. We don't trick them." Of course, Brin has a point. No one is forced to use Google, just as no one is forced to eat at McDonald's. But there's also something troubling about this argument, which minimizes the responsibility he might have to the billions of users who rely on the service Google provides, and in turn drive the company's billions in advertising revenue. To further muddle the picture, when the social repercussions of their work are troubling, the chief architects of the online world often fall back on the manifest destiny rhetoric of techno-determinism. Technologists, Siva Vaidyanathan points out, rarely say something could or should happen. They say it will happen. "The search engines of the future will be personalized," says Google Vice President Marissa Mayer, using the passive tense. Just as some Marxists believed that the economic conditions of a society would inevitably propel it through capitalism and toward a world socialist regime, it's easy to find engineers and techno-determinist pundits who believe that technology is on a set course. Sean Parker, the co-founder of Napster and rogue early president of Facebook, tells Vanity Fair that he's drawn to hacking because it's about re-architecting society. It's technology, not business or government, that's the real driving force behind large-scale societal shifts. Kevin Kelly, the founding editor of Wired, wrote perhaps the boldest book articulating the techno-determinist view, What Technology Wants, in which he posits that technology is a seventh kingdom of life, a kind of meta-organism with desires and tendencies of its own. Kelly believes that the technium, as he calls it, is more powerful than any of us mere humans. Ultimately, technology, a force that wants to eat power and expand choice, will get what it wants, whether we want it to or not. Technodeterminism is alluring and convenient for newly powerful entrepreneurs because it absolves them of responsibility for what they do. Like priests at the altar, they're mere vessels of a much larger force that it would be futile to resist. They need not concern themselves with the effects of the systems they've created. But technology doesn't solve every problem of its own accord. If it did, we wouldn't have millions of people starving to death in a world with an oversupply of food. It shouldn't be surprising that software entrepreneurs are incoherent about their social and political responsibilities. A great deal of this tension undoubtedly comes from the fact that the nature of online business is to scale up as quickly as possible. Once you're on the road to mass success and riches, often as a very young coder, there simply isn't much time to fully think all of this through. And the pressure of the venture capitalists breathing down your neck to monetize doesn't always offer much space for rumination on social responsibility. The $50 billion sandcastle. Once a year, the Y Combinator Startup Incubator hosts a day-long conference called Startup School, where successful tech entrepreneurs pass wisdom on to the aspiring audience of bright-eyed Y Combinator investees. The agenda typically includes many of the top CEOs in Silicon Valley, and in 2010, Mark Zuckerberg was at the top of the list. Zuckerberg was in an affable mood, dressed in a black t-shirt and jeans, and enjoying what was clearly a friendly crowd. Even so, when Jessica Livingston, his interviewer, asked him about The Social Network, the movie that had made him a household name, a range of emotions crossed his face. "It's interesting what kind of stuff they focused on getting right," Zuckerberg began. "Like every single shirt and fleece they had in that movie is actually a shirt or fleece that I own." Where there was an egregious discrepancy between fiction and reality, Zuckerberg told her, was how his own motivations were painted. "They frame it as if the whole reason for making Facebook and building something was that I wanted to get girls or wanted to get into some kind of social institution. And the reality, for people who know me, is that I've been dating the same girl since before I started Facebook. It's such a big disconnect. They just can't wrap their head around the idea that someone might build something because they like building things." It's entirely possible that the line was just a clever bit of Facebook PR, and there's no question that the 26-year-old billionaire is motivated by empire building, but the comment struck me as candid. For programmers, as for artists and craftsmen, making things is often its own best reward. Facebook's flaws and its founders' ill-conceived views about identity aren't the result of an antisocial, vindictive mindset. More likely, they're a natural consequence of the odd situations successful startups like Facebook create, in which a 20-something guy finds himself, in a matter of 5 years, in a position of great authority over the doings of 500 million human beings. One day you're making sandcastles, the next your sandcastle is worth $50 billion, and everyone in the world wants a piece of it. Of course, there are far worse business world personality types with whom to entrust the fabric of our social lives. With a reverence for rules, geeks tend to be principled, to carefully consider and then follow the rules they set for themselves and to stick to them under social pressure. They have a somewhat skeptical view of authority, Stanford professor Terry Winograd said of his former students, Page and Brin. If they see the world going one way, and they believe it should be going the other way, they are more like to say, the rest of the world is wrong, rather than, maybe we should reconsider. But the traits that fuel the best startups, aggression, a touch of arrogance, an interest in empire building, and of course, brilliant systematizing skills, can become a bit more problematic when you rule the world. Like pop stars who are vaulted onto the global stage, world-building engineers aren't always ready or willing to accept the enormous responsibility they come to hold when their creations start to teem with life. And it's not infrequently the case that engineers who are deeply mistrustful of power in the hands of others see themselves as supreme rationalists impervious to its effects. It may be that this is too much power to entrust to any small homogeneous group of individuals. Media moguls who get their start with a fierce commitment to the truth become the confidants of presidents and lose their edge. Businesses begun as social ventures become preoccupied with delivering shareholder value. In any case, one consequence of the current system is that we can end up placing a great deal of power in the hands of people who can have some pretty far-out, not entirely well-developed political ideas. Take Peter Thiel, one of Zuckerberg's early investors and mentors. Thiel has penthouse apartments in San Francisco and New York and a silver gullwing McLaren, the fastest car in the world. He also owns about 5% of Facebook. Despite his boyish, handsome features, Thiel often looks as though he's brooding, or maybe he's just lost in thought. In his teenage years, he was a high-ranking chess player, but stopped short of becoming a grandmaster. Taken too far, chess can become an alternate reality in which one loses sight of the real world, he told an interviewer for Fortune. My chess ability was roughly at the limit. Had I become any stronger, there would have been some massive trade-offs with success in other domains in life. In high school, he read Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago and J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings series, visions of corrupt and totalitarian power. At Stanford, he started a libertarian newspaper, The Stanford, to preach the gospel of freedom. In 1998, Thiel co-founded the company that would become PayPal, which he sold to eBay for $1.5 billion in 2002. Today, Thiel runs a multi-billion dollar hedge fund, Clarium, and a venture capital firm, Founders Fund, which invests in software companies throughout Silicon Valley. Thiel has made some legendary good picks, among them Facebook, in which he was the first outside investor. He's also made some bad ones. Clarium has lost billions in the last few years. But for Thiel, investing is more than a day job. It's an avocation. By starting a new internet business, an entrepreneur may create a new world, Thiel says. The hope of the internet is that these new worlds will impact and force change on the existing social and political order. His comments raise the question of what kind of change Thiel would like to see. While many billionaires are fairly circumspect about their political views, Thiel has been vocal, and it's safe to say that there are few with views as unusual as Thiel's. Peter wants to end the inevitability of death and taxes, Thiel's sometimes collaborator, Patry Friedman, grandson of Milton, told Wired. I mean, talk about aiming high! In an essay posted on the libertarian Cato Institute's website, Thiel describes why he believes that freedom and democracy are no longer compatible. Since 1920, he writes, the vast increase in welfare beneficiaries and the extension of the franchise to women, two constituencies that are notoriously tough for libertarians, have rendered the notion of capitalist democracy into an oxymoron. Then he outlines his hopes for the future, space exploration, seasteading, which involves building movable micro-countries on the open ocean and cyberspace. Thiel has poured millions into technologies to sequence genes and prolong life. He's also focused on preparing for the singularity, the moment a few decades from now when some futurists believe that humans and machines are likely to meld. In an interview, he argues that should the singularity arrive, one would be well advised to be on the side of the computers. Certainly, we would hope that an artificially intelligent computer would be friendly to human beings. At the same time, I don't think you'd want to be known as one of the human beings that is against computers and makes a living being against computers. If all this sounds a little fantastical, it doesn't worry Thiel. He's focused on the long view. Technology is at the center of what will determine the course of the 21st century, he says. There are aspects of it that are great and aspects that are terrible, and there are some real choices humans have to make about which technologies to foster and which ones we should be more careful about. Peter Thiel is entitled to his idiosyncratic views, of course, but they're worth paying attention to because they increasingly shape the world we all live in. There are only 4 other people on the Facebook board besides Mark Zuckerberg. Thiel is one of them, and Zuckerberg publicly describes him as a mentor. He helped shape the way I think about the business, Zuckerberg said in a 2006 Bloomberg News interview. As Thiel says, we have some big decisions to make about technology. And as for how those decisions get made, I have little hope, he writes, that voting will make things better. What game are you playing? Of course, not all engineers and geeks have the views about democracy and freedom that Peter Thiel does. He's surely an outlier. Craig Newmark, the founder of the free website Craigslist, spends most of his time arguing for geek values that include service and public-spiritedness. Jimmy Wales and the editors at Wikipedia work to make human knowledge free to everyone. The filtering Goliaths make huge contributions here as well. The democratic ideal of an enlightened, capable citizenry is well served by the broader set of relationships Facebook allows me to manage and the mountains of formerly hard-to-access research papers and other public information that Google has freed. But the engineering community can do more to strengthen the Internet's civic space. And to get a sense of the path ahead, I talked to Scott Heiferman. Heiferman, the founder of Meetup.com, is soft-spoken in a Midwestern sort of way. That's fitting, because he grew up in Homewood, Illinois, a small town on the outskirts of Chicago. It was a stretch to call it suburban, he says. His parents operated a paint store. As a teenager, Heiferman devoured material about Steve Jobs, eating up the story about how Jobs wooed a senior executive from Pepsi by asking him if he wanted to change the world or sell sugar water. Throughout my life, he told me, I've had a love-hate relationship with advertising. At the University of Iowa in the early 1990s, Heiferman studied engineering and marketing, but at night he ran a radio show called Advertorial Infotainment, in which he would remix and cut advertisements together to create a kind of sound art. He put the finished shows online and encouraged people to send in ads to remix, and the attention got him his first job, managing the website at Sony.com. After a few years as Sony's interactive marketing frontiersman, Heiferman founded iTraffic, one of the major early advertising companies of the web. Soon, iTraffic was the agency of record for clients like Disney and British Airways. But although the company was growing quickly, he was dissatisfied. The back of his business card had a mission statement about connecting people with brands they'd love, but he was increasingly uncertain that was a worthy endeavor. Perhaps he was selling sugar water after all. He left the company in 2000. For the remainder of the year and into 2001, Heiferman was in a funk. I was exhibiting what you could call being depressed, he says. When he heard the first word of the World Trade Center attacks on 9/11, he ran up to his Lower Manhattan rooftop and watched in horror. I talked to more strangers in the next 3 days, he says, than in the previous 5 years of living in New York. Shortly after the attacks, Heiferman came across the blog post that changed his life. It argued that the attacks, as awful as they were, might bring Americans back together in their civic life, and referenced the best-selling book, Bowling Alone. Heiferman bought a copy and read it cover to cover. I became captivated, he says, by the question of whether we could use technology to rebuild and strengthen community. Meetup.com, a site that makes it easy for local groups to meet face-to-face, was his answer. And today, Meetup serves over 79,000 local groups that do that. There's the Martial Arts Meetup in Orlando, and the Urban Spirituality Meetup in Barcelona, and the Black Singles Meetup in Houston. And Heiferman is a happier man. What I learned being in the ad business, he says, is that people can just go a long time without asking themselves what they should put their talent towards. You're playing a game, and you know the point of the game is to win. But what game are you playing? What are you optimizing for? If you're playing the game of trying to get the maximum downloads of your app, you'll make the better farting app. We don't need more things, he says. People are more magical than iPads. Your relationships are not media. Your friendships are not media. Love is not media. In his low-key way, Heiferman is getting worked up. Evangelizing this view of technology, that it ought to do something meaningful to make our lives more fulfilling and to solve the big problems we face, isn't as easy as it might seem. In addition to Meetup, more generally, Scott founded the New York Tech Meetup, a group of 10,000 software engineers who meet every month to preview new websites. At a recent meeting, Scott made an impassioned plea for the assembled group to focus on solving the problems that matter: education, healthcare, the environment. It didn't get a very good reception. In fact, he was just about booed off the stage. "We just want to do cool stuff," was the attitude, Scott told me later. "Don't bother me with this politics stuff." Techno-determinists like to suggest that technology is inherently good, but despite what Kevin Kelly says, technology is no more benevolent than a wrench or a screwdriver. It's only good, Melvin Kranzberg, a professor who studies the history of technology, put it best nearly 30 years ago, and his statement is now known as Kranzberg's first law. Technology is neither good or bad, nor is it neutral. For better or worse, programmers and engineers are in a position of remarkable power to shape the future of our society. They can use this power to help solve the big problems of our age: poverty, education, disease, or they can, as Heiferman says, make a better farting app. They're entitled to do either, of course, but it's disingenuous to have it both ways. To claim your enterprise is great and good when it suits you, and claim you're a mere sugar water salesman when it doesn't. Actually, building an informed and engaged citizenry in which people have the tools to help manage not only their own lives, but their own communities and societies, is one of the most fascinating and important engineering challenges. Solving it will take a great deal of technical skill mixed with humanistic understanding, a real feat. We need more programmers to go beyond Google's famous slogan, "Don't be evil." We need engineers who will do good. And we need them soon. If personalization remains on its current trajectory, as the next chapter describes, the near future could be stranger and more problematic than many of us would imagine. 7. What you want, whether you want it or not. There will always be plenty of things to compute in the detailed affairs of millions of people doing complicated things. Computing pioneer Vannevar Bush, 1945. All collected data had come to a final end. Nothing was left to be collected. But all collected data had yet to be completely correlated and put together in all possible relationships. From Isaac Asimov's short story, The Last Question. I recently received a friend invitation on Facebook from someone whose name I didn't recognize, a curvy-figured girl with big eyes and thick lashes. Clicking to figure out who she was, and, I'll admit, to look more closely, I read over her profile. It didn't tell me a lot about her, but it seemed like the profile of someone I might plausibly know. A few of our interests were the same. I looked again at the eyes. They were a little too big. In fact, when I looked more closely, I realized her profile picture wasn't even a photograph. It had been rendered by a 3D graphics program. There was no such person. My new attractive would-be friend was a figment of software, crawling through friend connections to harvest data from Facebook users. Even the list of movies and books she liked appeared to have been ripped from the lists of her friends. For lack of a better word, let's call her an advertar, a virtual being with a commercial purpose. As the filter bubble's membrane becomes thicker and harder to penetrate, advertars could become a powerful adaptive strategy. If I only get the news from my code and my friends, the easiest way to get my attention might be friends who are code. The technologies that support personalization will only get more powerful in the years ahead. Sensors that can pick up new personal signals and data streams will become even more deeply embedded in the surface of everyday life. The server farms that support the Googles and Amazons will grow, while the processors inside them shrink. That computing power will be unleashed to make increasingly precise guesses about our preferences and even our interior lives. Personalized augmented reality technologies will project an overlay over our experience of the real world, not just the digital one. Even Nicholas Negroponte's intelligent agents may make a comeback. Markets are strong forces, says Bill Joy, the legendary programmer who co-founded Sun Microsystems. They take you somewhere very quickly. And if where they take you is not where you want to go, you've got a problem. In 2002, the sci-fi movie Minority Report featured personalized holographic advertisements that accosted pedestrians as they walked down the street. In Tokyo, the first Minority Report-style personalized billboard has gone up outside of the NEC Corporation's headquarters, minus, for now, the holography. It's powered by the company's panel director software, which scans the faces of passers-by and matches them to a database of 10,000 stored photos to make guesses about their age and gender. When a young woman steps in front of the display, it responds instantly by showing her ads tailored to her. IBM's on the case, too. Its prototype advertising displays use remotely readable identity cards to greet viewers by name. In Reality Hunger, a book-length essay composed entirely of text fragments and reworked quotations, David Shields makes the case for the growing movement of artists who are breaking larger and larger chunks of reality into their work. Shields's examples are far-ranging, including The Blair Witch Project, Borat, and Curb Your Enthusiasm, karaoke, VH1's Behind the Music, and public access TV, The Eminem Show and The Daily Show, documentary and mockumentary. These pieces, he says, are the most vital art of our time, part of a new mode characterized by a deliberate unartiness and a blurring, to the point of invisibility, of any distinction between fiction and nonfiction, the lure and blur of the real. Truthiness, in Shields's view, is the future of art. As goes art, so goes technology. The future of personalization and of computing itself is a strange amalgam of the real and the virtual. It's a future where our cities and our bedrooms and all of the spaces in between exhibit what researchers call ambient intelligence. It's a future where our environments shift around us to suit our preferences and even our moods. And it's a future where advertisers will develop ever more powerful and reality-bending ways to make sure their products are seen. The days when the filter bubble disappears when we step away from our computers, in other words, are numbered. The robot with gaydar. Stanford law professor Ryan Kahlo thinks a lot about robots, but he doesn't spend much time musing about a future of cyborgs and androids. He's more interested in Roombas, the little robotic vacuum cleaners currently on the market. Roomba owners name their machines like pets. They delight in watching the little bumbling devices wander around the room. Roombas provoke an emotional response, even a sense of relationship. And in the next few years, they'll be joined by a small army of consumer electronic brethren. The increasing prevalence of human-like machines in everyday life presents us with new dilemmas in personalization and privacy. The emotions provoked by humanness, both virtually, avatars, and in reality, human-like robots, are powerful. And when people begin to relate to machines as we do to humans, we can be convinced to reveal implicit information that we would never directly give away. For one thing, the presence of humanoid faces changes behavior, compelling people to behave more like they're in public. The Chinese experiment with Jing Jing and Cha Cha, the cartoon internet police, is one example of this power. On the one hand, Kalo points out, people are much less likely to volunteer private information when being interrogated by a virtual agent than when simply filling out a form. This is part of why the intelligent agent craze didn't work out the first time around. In many cases, it's easier to get people to share personal information if they feel as though they're privately entering it into an impersonal machine rather than sharing it with people. On the other hand, when Harvard researchers Terrence Burnham and Brian Hare asked volunteers to play a game in which they could choose to donate money or keep it, a picture of the friendly-looking robot Kismet increased donations by 30%. Human-like agents tend to make us clam up on the intimate details of our lives because they make us feel as if we're actually around other people. For elderly folks living alone or a child recovering in a hospital, a virtual or robotic friend can be a great relief from loneliness and boredom. This is all to the good, but human-like agents also have a great deal of power to shape our behavior. Computers programmed to be polite or to evidence certain personalities, Kalo writes, have profound effects on the politeness, acceptance, and other behavior of test subjects. And because they engage with people, they can pull out implicit information that we'd never intend to divulge. A flirty robot, for example, might be able to read subconscious cues, eye contact, body language, to quickly identify personality traits of its interlocutor. The challenge, Kalo says, is that it's hard to remember that human-like software and hardware aren't human at all. Avatars or robotic assistants may have access to the whole set of personal data that exists online. They may know more about you, more precisely, than your best friend. And as persuasion and personality profiling get better, they'll develop an increasingly nuanced sense of how to shift your behaviors. Which brings us back to the avatar. In an attention-limited world, lifelike and especially human-like signals stand out. We're hardwired to pay attention to them. It's far easier to ignore a billboard than an attractive person calling your name. And as a result, advertisers may well decide to invest in technology that allows them to insert human advertisements into social spaces. The next attractive man or woman who friends you on Facebook could turn out to be an ad for a bag of chips. As Kalo puts it, people are not evolved to 20th century technology. The human brain evolved in a world in which only humans exhibited rich social behaviors, and a world in which all perceived objects were real physical objects. Now, all that's shifting. The future is already here. The future of personalization is driven by a simple economic calculation. Signals about our personal behavior and the computing power necessary to crunch through them are becoming cheaper than ever to acquire. And as that cost collapses, strange new possibilities come within reach. Take facial recognition. Using Morris, a $3,000 iPhone app, the police in Brockton, Massachusetts can snap a photo of a suspect and check his or her identity and criminal record in seconds. Tag a few pictures with Picasa, Google's photo management tool, and the software can already pick out who's who in a collection of photos. And according to Eric Schmidt, the same is true of Google's cache of images from the entire web. "Give us 14 images of you," he told a crowd of technologists at the Techonomy conference in 2010, "and we can find other images of you with 95% accuracy." As of the end of 2010, however, this feature isn't available in Google Image Search. Face.com, an Israeli startup, may offer the service before the search giant does. It's not every day that a company develops a highly useful and world-changing technology and then waits for a competitor to launch it first. But Google has good reason to be concerned. The ability to search by face will shatter many of our cultural illusions about privacy and anonymity. Many of us will be caught in flagrante delicto. It's not just that your friends and enemies will be able to easily find pictures other people have taken of you, as if the whole internet has been tagged on Facebook. They will also be able to find pictures other people took of other people, in which you happen to be walking by or smoking a cigarette in the background. After the data has been crunched, the rest is easy. Want to search for two people, say your boyfriend and that overly friendly intern you suspect him of dallying with, or your employee in that executive who's been trying to woo him away? Easy. Want to build a Facebook-style social graph by looking at who appears most often with whom? A cinch. Want to see which of your coworkers posted profiles on anonymous dating sites, or, for that matter, photos of themselves in various states of undress? Want to see what your new friend used to look like in his drugged-out days? Want to find mobsters in the Witness Protection Program or spies in deep cover? The possibilities are nearly limitless. To be sure, doing face recognition right takes an immense amount of computing power. The tool in Picasa is slow. On my laptop, it crunches for minutes. So, for the time being, it may be too expensive to do it well for the whole web. But face recognition has Moore's Law, one of the most powerful laws in computing, on its side. Every year, as processor speed per dollar doubles, it'll get twice as cheap to do. Sooner or later, mass face recognition, perhaps even in real time, which would allow for recognition on security and video feeds, will roll out. Facial recognition is especially significant because it'll create a kind of privacy discontinuity. We're used to a public semi-anonymity. While we know we may be spotted in a club or on the street, it's unlikely that we will be. But as security camera and camera phone pictures become searchable by face, that expectation will slip away. Shops with cameras facing the doors and aisles will be able to watch precisely where individual customers wander, what they pick up, and how this correlates with the data already collected about them by firms like Axiom. And this powerful set of data, where you go and what you do as indicated by where your face shows up in the bitstream, can be used to provide ever more custom-tailored experiences. It's not just people that will be easier than ever to track. It's also individual objects, what some researchers are calling the Internet of Things. As sci-fi author William Gibson once said, "The future is already here. It's just not very evenly distributed. It shows up in some places before others." And one of the places this particular aspect of the future has shown up first, oddly enough, is the Coca-Cola Village amusement park, a holiday village, theme park, and marketing event that opens seasonally in Israel. Sponsored by Facebook and Coke, the teenagers attending the park in the summer of 2010 were given bracelets containing a tiny piece of circuitry that allowed them to like real-world objects. Wave the bracelet at the entrance to a ride, for example, and a status update posted to your account testifies that you're about to embark. Take a picture of your friends with a special camera and wave the bracelet at it, and the photos posted with your identity already tagged. Embedded in each bracelet is a radio frequency identification, RFID chip. RFID chips don't need batteries, and there's only one way to use them: call and response. Provide a little wireless electromagnetic power, and the chip chirps out a unique identifying code. Correlate the code with, say, a Facebook account, and you're in business. A single chip can cost as little as 7 cents, and they'll cost far less in the years to come. Suddenly, it's possible for businesses to track each individual object they make across the globe. Affix a chip to an individual car part, and you can watch as the part travels to the car factory, gets assembled into a car, and makes its way to the show floor and then someone's garage. No more inventory shrinkage, no more having to recall whole models of products because of the errors of one factory. Conversely, RFID provides a framework by which a home could automatically inventory every object inside it and track which objects are in which rooms. With a powerful enough signal, RFID could be a permanent solution to the lost keys problem and bring us face to face with what Forbes writer Raihan Salam calls the powerful promise of a real world that can be indexed and organized as cleanly and coherently as Google has indexed and organized the web. This phenomenon is called ambient intelligence. It's based on a simple observation. The items you own, where you put them, and what you do with them is, after all, a great signal about what kind of person you are and what kind of preferences you have. In the near future, writes a team of ambient intelligence experts led by David Wright, every manufactured product, our clothes, money, appliances, the paint on our walls, the carpets on our floors, our cars, everything will be embedded with intelligence, networks of tiny sensors and actuators, which some have termed smart dust. And there's a third set of powerful signals that is getting cheaper and cheaper. In 1990, it cost about $10 to sequence a single base pair, one letter, of DNA. By 1999, that number had dropped to 90 cents. In 2004, it crossed the 1 cent threshold, and now, as I write in 2010, it costs 1/10,000th of 1 cent. By the time this book comes out, it'll undoubtedly cost exponentially less. By some point mid-decade, we ought to be able to sequence any random whole human genome for less than the cost of a sandwich. It seems like something out of Gattaca, but the allure of adding this data to our profiles will be strong. While it's increasingly clear that our DNA doesn't determine everything about us, other cellular information sets, hormones, and our environment play a large role, there are undoubtedly numerous correlations between genetic material and behavior to be made. It's not just that we'll be able to predict and avert upcoming health issues with far greater accuracy, though that alone will be enough to get many of us in the door. By adding together DNA and behavioral data, like the location information from iPhones or the text of Facebook status updates, an enterprising scientist could run statistical regression analysis on an entire society. In all this data lie patterns yet undreamed of. Properly harnessed, it will fuel a level of filtering acuity that's hard to imagine, a world in which nearly all of our objective experience is quantified, captured, and used to inform our environments. The biggest challenge, in fact, may be thinking of the right questions to ask of these enormous flows of binary digits, and increasingly, code will learn to ask these questions itself. The end of theory. In December 2010, researchers at Harvard, Google, Encyclopedia Britannica, and the American Heritage Dictionary announced the results of a 4-year joint effort. The team had built a database spanning the entire contents of over 500 years' worth of books, 5.2 million books in total, in English, French, Chinese, German, and other languages. Now, any visitor to Google's Ngram viewer page can query it and watch how phrases rise and fall in popularity over time, from neologism to the long fade into obscurity. For the researchers, the tool suggested even grander possibilities, a quantitative approach to the humanities in which cultural changes can be scientifically mapped and measured. The initial findings suggest how powerful the tool can be. By looking at the references to previous dates, the team found that humanity is forgetting its past faster with each passing year. And, they argued, the tool could provide a powerful tool for automatically identifying censorship and propaganda by identifying countries and languages in which there was a statistically abnormal absence of certain ideas or phrases. Leon Trotsky, for example, shows up far less in mid-century Russian books than in English or French books of the same time. The project is undoubtedly a great service to researchers and the casually curious public, but serving academia probably wasn't Google's only motive. Remember Larry Page's declaration that he wanted to create a machine that can understand anything, which some people might call artificial intelligence? In Google's approach to creating intelligence, the key is data, and the 5 million digitized books contain an awful lot of it. To grow your artificial intelligence, you need to keep it well fed. To get a sense of how this works, consider Google Translate, which can now do a passable job translating automatically among nearly 60 languages. You might imagine that Translate was built with a really big, really sophisticated set of translating dictionaries, but you'd be wrong. Instead, Google's engineers took a probabilistic approach. They built software that could identify which words tended to appear in connection with which, and then sought out large chunks of data that were available in multiple languages to train the software on. One of the largest chunks was patent and trademark filings, which are useful because they all say the same thing. They're in the public domain, and they have to be filed globally in scores of different languages. Set loose on 100,000 patent applications in English and French, Translate could determine that when Word showed up in the English document, Mo was likely to show up in the corresponding French paper. And as users correct Translate's work over time, it gets better and better. What Translate is doing with foreign languages, Google aims to do with just about everything. Co-founder Sergey Brin has expressed his interest in plumbing genetic data. Google Voice captures millions of minutes of human speech, which engineers are hoping they can use to build the next generation of speech recognition software. Google Research has captured most of the scholarly articles in the world, and of course, Google's search users pour billions of queries into the machine every day, which provide another rich vein of cultural information. If you had a secret plan to vacuum up an entire civilization's data and use it to build artificial intelligence, you couldn't do a whole lot better. As Google's proto-brain increases in sophistication, it'll open up remarkable new possibilities. Researchers in Indonesia can benefit from the latest papers in Stanford, and vice versa, without waiting for translation delays. In a matter of a few years, it may be possible to have an automatically translated voice conversation with someone speaking a different language, opening up whole new channels of cross-cultural communication and understanding. But as these systems become increasingly intelligent, they also become harder to control and understand. It's not quite right to say they take on a life of their own. Ultimately, they're still just code. But they reach a level of complexity at which even their programmers can't fully explain any given output. This is already true to a degree with Google's search algorithm. Even to its engineers, the workings of the algorithm are somewhat mysterious. If they opened up the mechanics, says search expert Danny Sullivan, you still wouldn't understand it. Google could tell you all 200 signals it uses and what the code is, and you wouldn't know what to do with them. The core software engine of Google Search is hundreds of thousands of lines of code. According to one Google employee I talked to who had spoken to the search team, the team tweaks and tunes. They don't really know what works or why it works. They just look at the result. Google promises that it doesn't tilt the deck in favor of its own products, but the more complex and intelligent the system gets, the harder it'll be to tell. Pinpointing where bias or error exists in a human brain is difficult or impossible. There are just too many neurons and connections to narrow it down to a single malfunctioning chunk of tissue. And as we rely on intelligent systems like Google's more, their opacity could cause real problems, like the still mysterious machine-driven flash crash that caused the Dow to drop 600 points in a few minutes on May 6, 2010. In a provocative article in Wired, editor-in-chief Chris Anderson argued that huge databases render scientific theory itself obsolete. Why spend time formulating human language hypotheses, after all, when you can quickly analyze trillions of bits of data and find the clusters and correlations? He quotes Peter Norvig, Google's research director, "All models are wrong, and increasingly you can succeed without them." There's plenty to be said for this approach, but it's worth remembering the downside. Machines may be able to see results without models, but humans can't understand without them. There's value in making the processes that run our lives comprehensible to the humans who, at least in theory, are their beneficiaries. Supercomputer inventor Danny Hillis once said that the greatest achievement of human technology is tools that allow us to create more than we understand. That's true, but the same trait is also the source of our greatest disasters. The more the code driving personalization comes to resemble the complexity of human cognition, the harder it'll be to understand why or how it's making the decisions it makes. A simple coded rule that bars people from one group or class from certain kinds of access is easy to spot, but when the same action is the result of a swirling mass of correlations in a global supercomputer, it's a trickier problem. And the result is that it's harder to hold these systems and their tenders accountable for their actions. No such thing as a free virtual lunch. In January 2009, if you were listening to one of 25 radio stations in Mexico, you might have heard the accordion ballad El Más Grande Enemigo. Though the tune is polka-ish and cheery, the lyrics depict a tragedy. A migrant seeks to illegally cross the border, is betrayed by his handler, and is left in the blistering desert sun to die. Another song from the Migra Corridos album tells a different piece of the same sad tale. To cross the border, I got in the back of a trailer. There I shared my sorrows with 40 other immigrants. I was never told that this was a trip to hell. If the lyrics aren't exactly subtle about the dangers of crossing the border, that's the point. Migra Corridos was produced by a contractor working for the U.S. Border Control as part of a campaign to stem the tide of immigrants along the border. The song is a prime example of a growing trend in what marketers delicately call advertiser-funded media, or AFM. Product placement has been in vogue for decades, and AFM is its natural next step. Advertisers love product placement because in a media environment in which it's harder and harder to get people to pay attention to anything, especially ads, it provides a kind of loophole. You can't fast-forward past product placement. You can't miss it without missing some of the actual content. AFM is just a natural extension of the same logic. Media have always been vehicles for selling products, the argument goes, so why not just cut out the middleman and have product makers produce the content themselves? In 2010, Walmart and Procter & Gamble announced a partnership to produce Secrets of the Mountain and The Jensen Project, family movies that will feature characters using the company's products throughout. Michael Bay, the director of Transformers, has started a new company called The Institute, whose tagline is, "Where brand science meets great storytelling." Hansel and Gretel in 3D, its first feature production, will be specially crafted to provide product placement hooks throughout. Now that the video game industry is far more profitable than the movie industry, it provides a huge opportunity for in-game advertising and product placement as well. Massive Incorporated, a game advertising platform acquired by Microsoft for $200 million to $400 million, has placed ads on in-game billboards and city walls for companies like Singular and McDonald's, and has the capacity to track which individual users saw which advertisements for how long. Splinter Cell, a game by Ubisoft, works placement for products like Axe deodorant into the architecture of the cityscape that characters travel through. Even books aren't immune. Kathy's book, a young adult title published in September 2006, has its heroine applying a killer coat of lip slicks in Daring. That's not a coincidence. Kathy's book was published by Procter & Gamble, the corporate owner of lip slicks. If the product placement and advertiser-funded media industries continue to grow, personalization will offer whole new vistas of possibility. Why name-drop lip slicks when your reader is more likely to buy CoverGirl? Why have a video game chase scene through Macy's when the guy holding the controller is more of an Old Navy type? When software engineers talk about architecture, they're usually talking metaphorically. But as people spend more of their time in virtual, personalizable places, there's no reason that these worlds can't change to suit users' preferences, or, for that matter, a corporate sponsor's.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
A Shifting World. The enriched psychological models and new data flows measuring everything from heart rate to music choices open up new frontiers for online personalization, in which what changes isn't just a choice of products or news clips, but the look and feel of the site on which they're displayed. Why should websites look the same to every viewer or customer? Different people don't respond only to different products, they respond to different design sensibilities, different colors, even different types of product descriptions. It's easy enough to imagine a Walmart website with softened edges and warm pastels for some customers and a hard-edged, minimalist design for others. And once that capacity exists, why stick with just one design per customer? Maybe it's best to show me one side of the Walmart brand when I'm angry and another when I'm happy. This kind of approach isn't a futuristic fantasy. A team led by John Hauser at MIT's Business School has developed the basic techniques for what they call website morphing, in which a shopping site analyzes users' clicks to figure out what kinds of information and styles of presentation are most effective, and then adjusts the layout to suit a particular user's cognitive style. Hauser estimates that websites that morph can increase purchase intentions by 21%. Industry-wide, that's worth billions. And what starts with the sale of consumer products won't end there. News and entertainment sources that morph ought to enjoy an advantage as well. On one hand, morphing makes us feel more at home on the web. Drawing from the data we provide, every website can feel like an old friend. But it also opens the door to a strange, dreamlike world in which our environment is constantly rearranging itself behind our backs. And like a dream, it may be less and less possible to share with people outside of it, that is, everyone else. Thanks to augmented reality, that experience may soon be par for the course offline as well. On the modern battlefield, Raytheon avionics manager Todd Lovell told a reporter, there is way more data out there than most people can use. If you are just trying to see it all through your eyes and read it in bits and bytes, you're never going to understand it. So the key to the modern technology is to take all that data and turn it into useful information that the pilot can recognize very quickly and act upon. What Google does for online information, Lovell's Scorpion project aims to do for the real world. Fitting like a monocle over one of a jet pilot's eyes, the Scorpion display device annotates what a pilot sees in real time. It color codes potential threats, highlights when and where the aircraft has a missile lock, assists with night vision, and reduces the need for pilots to look at a dashboard in an environment where every microsecond matters. It turns the whole world into a display, jet pilot Paul Mancini told the Associated Press. This is augmented reality technology, and it's moving rapidly from the cockpits of jet planes to consumer devices that can tune out the noise and turn up the signal of everyday life. Using your iPhone camera and an app developed by Yelp, the restaurant recommendation service, you can see eateries' ratings haphazardly displayed over their real-world storefronts. A new kind of noise-canceling headphone can sense and amplify human voices while tuning out other street or airplane noise down to a whisper. The Meadowlands football stadium is spending $100 million on new applications that give fans who attend games in person the ability to slice and dice the game in real time, view key statistics as they happen, and watch the action unfold from a variety of angles, the full high-information TV experience overlaid on a real game. At DARPA, the Defense Research and Development Agency, technologies are being developed that make Scorpion look positively quaint. Since 2002, DARPA has been pushing forward research in what it calls augmented cognition, or AugCog, which uses cognitive neuroscience and brain imaging to figure out how best to route important information into the brain. AugCog begins with the premise that there are basic limits as to how many tasks a person can juggle at a time, and that this capacity itself may fluctuate from moment to moment, depending on a host of factors, including mental fatigue, novelty, boredom, and stress. By monitoring activity in brain areas associated with memory, decision-making, and the like, AugCog devices can figure out how to make sure to highlight the information that most matters. If you're absorbing as much visual input as you can, the system might decide to send an audio alert instead. One trial, according to The Economist, gave users of an AugCog device a 100% improvement in recall and a 500% increase in working memory. And if it sounds far-fetched, just remember, the folks at DARPA also helped invent the Internet. Augmented reality is a booming field, and Gary Hayes, a personalization and augmented reality expert in Australia, sees at least 16 different ways it could be used to provide services and make money. In his vision, guide companies could offer augmented reality tours, in which information about buildings, museum artifacts, and streets is superimposed on the environs. Shoppers could use phone apps to immediately get readouts on products they're interested in, including what the objects cost elsewhere. Amazon.com already provides a rudimentary version of this service. Augmented reality games could layer clues into real-world environments. Augmented reality tech provides value, but it also provides an opportunity to reach people with new attention-getting forms of advertising. For a price, digital sportscasts are already capable of layering corporate logos onto football fields. But this new technology offers the opportunity to do that in a personalized way in the real world. You turn on the app to, say, help find a friend in a crowd, and project it onto a nearby building as a giant Coke ad featuring your face and your name. And when you combine the personalized filtering of what we see and hear with, say, face recognition, things get pretty interesting. You begin to be able to filter not just information, but people. As the co-founder of OkCupid, one of the web's most popular dating sites, Chris Coyne has been thinking about filtering for people for a while. Coyne speaks in an energetic, sincere manner, furrowing his brows when he's thinking and waving his hands to illustrate. As a math major, he got interested in how to use algorithms to solve problems for people. There are lots of ways you can use math to do things that turn a profit, he told me over a steaming bowl of bibimbap in New York's Koreatown. Many of his classmates went off to high-paid jobs at hedge funds. But, he said, what we were interested in was using it to make people happy. And what better way to make people happy than to help them fall in love. The more Coyne and his college hallmates, Sam Yeager and Max Krohn, looked at other dating sites, the more annoyed they got. It was clear that other dating sites were more interested in getting people to pay for credits than to hook up. And once you did pay, you'd often see profiles of people who were no longer on the site or who would never write you back. Coyne and his team decided to approach the problem with math. The service would be free. Instead of offering a one-size-fits-all solution, they'd use number crunching to develop a personalized matching algorithm for each person on the site. And just as Google optimizes for clicks, they'd do everything they could to maximize the likelihood of real conversations. If you could solve for that, they figured, profits would follow. In essence, they built a modern search engine for mates. When you log on to OkCupid, you're asked a series of questions about yourself. Do you believe in God? Would you ever participate in a threesome? Does smoking disgust you? Would you sleep with someone on the first date? Do you have an STD? Answer yes, and you get sent to another site. You also indicate how you'd like a prospective partner to answer the same questions and how important their answers are to you. Using these questions, OkCupid builds a custom-weighted equation to figure out your perfect match. And when you search for people in your area, it uses the same algorithm to rank the likelihood of your getting along. OkCupid's powerful cluster of servers can rank 10,000 people with a 200-question match model and return results in less than a tenth of a second. They have to, because OkCupid's traffic is booming. Hundreds of thousands of answers to poll questions flow into their system each night. Thousands of new users sign up each day, and the system is getting better and better. Looking into the future, Coyne told me, you'll have people walking around with augmented displays. He described a guy on a night out. You walk into a bar, and a camera immediately scans the faces in the room and matches them against OkCupid's databases. Your accessories can say, that girl over there is an 88% match. That's a dream come true. Vladimir Nabokov once commented that reality is one of the few words that mean nothing without quotes. Coyne's vision may soon be our reality. There's tremendous promise in this vision. Surgeons who never miss a suture. Soldiers who never imperil civilians. And everywhere a more informed, information-dense world. But there's also danger. Augmented reality represents the end of naive empiricism, of the world as we see it, and the beginning of something far more mutable and weird, a real-world filter bubble that will be increasingly difficult to escape. Losing control. There's plenty to love about this ubiquitously personalized future. Smart devices, from vacuum cleaners to light bulbs to picture frames, offer the promise that our environments will be exactly the way we want them, wherever we are. In the near future, ambient intelligence expert David Wright suggests, we might even carry our room lighting preferences with us. When there are multiple people in a room, a consensus could be automatically reached by averaging preferences and waiting for who's the host. OgCog-enabled devices will help us track the data streams that we consider most important. In some situations, say medical or fire alerts that find ways to escalate until they capture our attention, they could save lives. And while brainwave reading OgCog is probably some way off for the masses, consumer variants of the basic concept are already being put into place. Google's Gmail priority inbox, which screens emails and highlights the ones it assesses as more important, is an early riff on the theme. Meanwhile, augmented reality filters offer the possibility of an annotated and hyperlinked reality, in which what we see is infused with information that allows us to work better, assimilate information more quickly, and make better decisions. That's the good side. But there's always a bargain in personalization. In exchange for convenience, you hand over some privacy and control to the machine. As personal data become more and more valuable, the behavioral data market described in Chapter 1 is likely to explode. When a clothing company determines that knowing your favorite color produces a $5 increase in sales, it has an economic basis for pricing that data point and for other websites to find reasons to ask you. While OkCupid is mum about its business model, it likely rests on offering advertisers the ability to target its users based on the hundreds of personal questions they answer. While many of these data acquisitions will be legitimate, some won't be. Data are uniquely suited to gray market activities because they need not carry any trace of where they have come from or where they have been along the way. Wright calls this data laundering, and it's already well underway. Spyware and spam companies sell questionably derived data to middlemen, who then add it to the databases powering the marketing campaigns of major corporations. Moreover, because the transformations applied to your data are often opaque, it's not always clear exactly what decisions are being made on your behalf, by whom, or to what end. This matters plenty when we're talking about information streams, but it matters even more when this power is infused into our sensory apparatus itself. In 2000, Bill Joy, the Sun Microsystems co-founder, wrote a piece for Wired magazine titled, "Why the Future Doesn't Need Us." As society and the problems that face it become more and more complex and machines become more and more intelligent, he wrote, people will let machines make more of their decisions for them, simply because machine-made decisions will bring better results than man-made ones. This may often be the case. Machine-driven systems do provide significant value. The whole promise of these technologies is that they give us more freedom and more control over our world. Lights that respond to our whims and moods, screens and overlays that allow us to attend only to the people we want to, so that we don't have to do the busy work of living. The irony is that they offer this freedom and control by taking it away. It's one thing when a remote control's array of buttons elides our ability to do something basic, like flip the channels. It's another thing when what the remote controls is our lives. It's fair to guess that the technology of the future will work about as well as the technology of the past, which is to say, well enough, but not perfectly. There will be bugs. There will be dislocations and annoyances. There will be breakdowns that cause us to question whether the whole system was worth it in the first place. And we'll live with the threat that systems made to support us will be turned against us. That a clever hacker who cracks the baby monitor now has a surveillance device. That someone who can interfere with what we see can expose us to danger. The more power we have over our own environments, the more power someone who assumes the controls has over us. That is why it's worth keeping the basic logic of these systems in mind. You don't get to create your world on your own. You live in an equilibrium between your own desires and what the market will bear. And while in many cases this provides for healthier, happier lives, it also provides for the commercialization of everything, even of our sensory apparatus itself. There are few things uglier to contemplate than OGCOG-enabled ads that escalate until they seize control of your attention. We're compelled to return to Jaron Lanier's question, for whom do these technologies work? If history is any guide, we may not be the primary customer. And as technology gets better and better at directing our attention, we need to watch closely what it is directing our attention toward. 8. Escape from the City of Ghettos. In order to find his own self, a person also needs to live in a milieu where the possibility of many different value systems is explicitly recognized and honored. More specifically, he needs a great variety of choices so that he is not misled about the nature of his own person. Christopher Alexander et al., A Pattern Language. In theory, there's never been a structure more capable of allowing all of us to shoulder the responsibility for understanding and managing our world than the Internet. But in practice, the Internet is headed in a different direction. Sir Tim Berners-Lee, the creator of the World Wide Web, captured the gravity of this threat in a recent call to arms in the pages of Scientific American titled "Long Live the Web." "The web as we know it," he wrote, "is being threatened. Some of its most successful inhabitants have begun to chip away at its principles. Large social networking sites are walling off information posted by their users from the rest of the web. Governments, totalitarian and democratic alike, are monitoring people's online habits, endangering important human rights. If we, the web's users, allow these and other trends to proceed unchecked, the web could be broken into fragmented islands." In this book, I've argued that the rise of pervasive, embedded filtering is changing the way we experience the Internet and ultimately the world. At the center of this transformation is the fact that for the first time, it's possible for a medium to figure out who you are, what you like, and what you want. Even if the personalizing code isn't always spot on, it's accurate enough to be profitable, not just by delivering better ads, but also by adjusting the substance of what we read, see, and hear. As a result, while the Internet offers access to a dazzling array of sources and options, in the filter bubble, we'll miss many of them. While the Internet can give us new opportunities to grow and experiment with our identities, the economics of personalization push toward a static conception of personhood. While the Internet has the potential to decentralize knowledge and control, in practice, it's concentrating control over what we see and what opportunities we're offered in the hands of fewer people than ever before. Of course, there are some advantages to the rise of the personalized Internet. I enjoy using Pandora, Netflix, and Facebook as much as the next person. I appreciate Google's shortcuts through the information jungle and couldn't have written this book without them. But what's troubling about this shift toward personalization is that it's largely invisible to users and, as a result, out of our control. We are not even aware that we're seeing increasingly divergent images of the Internet. The Internet may know who we are, but we don't know who it thinks we are or how it's using that information. Technology designed to give us more control over our lives is actually taking control away. Ultimately, Sun Microsystems co-founder Bill Joy told me, information systems have to be judged on their public outcomes. If what the Internet does is spread around a lot of information, fine. But what did that cause to happen? He asked. If it's not helping us solve the really big problems, what good is it? We really need to address the core issues: climate change, political instability in Asia and the Middle East, demographic problems, and the decline of the middle class. In the context of problems of this magnitude, you'd hope that a new constituency would emerge, but there's a distraction overlay: false issues, entertainment, gaming. If our system with all the freedom of choice is not addressing the problems, something's wrong. Something is wrong with our media. But the Internet isn't doomed for a simple reason. The new medium is nothing if not plastic. Its great strength, in fact, is its capacity for change. Through a combination of individual action, corporate responsibility, and governmental regulation, it's still possible to shift course. "We create the web," Sir Tim Berners-Lee wrote. "We choose what properties we want it to have and not have. It is by no means finished, and it's certainly not dead." It's still possible to build information systems that introduce us to new ideas, that push us in new ways. It's still possible to create media that show us what we don't know, rather than reflecting what we do. It's still possible to erect systems that don't trap us in an endless loop of self-flattery about our own interests or shield us from fields of inquiry that aren't our own. First, however, we need a vision, a sense of what to aim for. The Mosaic of Subcultures. In 1975, architect Christopher Alexander and a team of colleagues began publishing a series of books that would change the face of urban planning, design, and programming. The most famous volume, A Pattern Language, is a guidebook that reads like a religious text. It's filled with quotes and aphorisms and hand-drawn sketches, a Bible guiding devotees toward a new way of thinking about the world. The question that had consumed Alexander and his team during 8 years of research was the question of why some places thrived and worked while others didn't. Why some cities and neighborhoods and houses flourished while others were grim and desolate. The key, Alexander argued, was that design has to fit its literal and cultural context, and the best way to ensure that, they concluded, was to use a pattern language, a set of design specifications for human spaces. Even for non-architects, the book is an entrancing read. There's a pattern that describes the ideal nook for kids. The ceiling should be between 2 feet 6 inches and 4 feet high, and another 4 high places where you can look down and survey your world. Every society which is alive and whole, Alexander wrote, will have its own unique and distinct pattern language. Some of the book's most intriguing sections illuminate the patterns that successful cities are built on. Alexander imagines 2 metropolises, the heterogeneous city, where people are mixed together irrespective of lifestyle and background, and the city of ghettos, where people are grouped together tightly by category. The heterogeneous city seems rich, Alexander writes, but actually it dampens all significant variety and arrests most of the possibilities for differentiation. Though there's a diverse mix of peoples and cultures, all of the parts of the city are diverse in the same way. Shaped by the lowest common cultural denominators, the city looks the same everywhere you go. Meanwhile, in the city of ghettos, some people get trapped in the small world of a single subculture that doesn't really represent who they are. Without connections and overlap between communities, subcultures that make up the city don't evolve. As a result, the ghettos breed stagnation and intolerance. But Alexander offers a third possibility, a happy medium between closed ghettos and the undifferentiated mass of the heterogeneous city. He called it the Mosaic of Subcultures. In order to achieve this kind of city, Alexander explains, designers should encourage neighborhoods with cultural character, but though these subcultures must be sharp and distinct and separate, they must not be closed. They must be readily accessible to one another, so that a person can move easily from one to another and can settle in the one which suits him best. Alexander's mosaic is based on 2 premises about human life. First, a person can only fully become him or herself in a place where he or she receives support for his idiosyncrasies from the people and values which surround him. And second, as the quotation at the beginning of this chapter suggests, you have to see lots of ways of living in order to choose the best life for yourself. This is what the best cities do. They cultivate a vibrant array of cultures and allow their citizens to find their way to the neighborhoods and traditions in which they're most at home. Alexander was writing about cities, but what's beautiful about a pattern language is that it can be applied to any space in which humans gather and live, including the internet. Online communities and niches are important. They're the places where new ideas and styles and themes and even languages get formed and tested. They're the places where we can feel most at home. An internet built like the heterogeneous city described by Alexander wouldn't be a very pleasant place to be, a whirling chaos of facts and ideas and communications. But by the same token, nobody wants to live in the city of ghettos. And that's where personalization, if it's too acute, will take us. At its worst, the filter bubble confines us to our own information neighborhood, unable to see or explore the rest of the enormous world of possibilities that exist online. We need our online urban planners to strike a balance between relevance and serendipity, between the comfort of seeing friends and the exhilaration of meeting strangers, between cozy niches and wide open spaces. What individuals can do. Social media researcher Dana Boyd was right when she warned that we are at risk of the psychological equivalent of obesity. And while creating a healthy information diet requires action on the part of the companies that supply the food, that doesn't work unless we also change our own habits. Corn syrup vendors aren't likely to change their practices until consumers demonstrate that they're looking for something else. Here's one place to start. Stop being a mouse. On an episode of the radio program, This American Life, host Ira Glass investigates how to build a better mousetrap. He talks to Andy Woolworth, the man at the world's largest mousetrap manufacturer, who fields ideas for new trap designs. The proposed ideas vary from the impractical, a trap that submerges the mouse in antifreeze, which then needs to be thrown out by the bucket, to the creepy, a design that kills rodents using, yes, gas pellets. But the punchline is that they're all unnecessary. Woolworth has an easy job because the existing traps are very cheap and work within a day 88% of the time. Mouse traps work because mice generally establish a food-seeking route within 10 feet of where they are, returning to it up to 30 times a day. Place a trap in its vicinity, and chances are very good that you'll catch your mouse. Most of us are pretty mouse-like in our information habits. I admittedly am. There are 3 or 4 websites that I check frequently each day, and I rarely vary them or add new ones to my repertoire. Whether we live in Calcutta or San Francisco, Matt Kohler told me, we all kind of do the same thing over and over again most of the time, and jumping out of that recursion loop is not easy to do. Habits are hard to break. But just as you notice more about the place you live when you take a new route to work, varying your path online dramatically increases your likelihood of encountering new ideas and people. Just by stretching your interests in new directions, you give the personalizing code more breadth to work with. Someone who shows interest in opera and comic books and South African politics and Tom Cruise is harder to pigeonhole than someone who just shows interest in one of those things. And by constantly moving the flashlight of your attention to the perimeter of your understanding, you enlarge your sense of the world. Going off the beaten track is scary at first, but the experiences we have when we come across new ideas, people, and cultures are powerful. They make us feel human. Serendipity is a shortcut to joy. For some of the identity cascade problems discussed in Chapter 5, regularly erasing the cookies your internet browser uses to identify who you are is a partial cure. Most browsers these days make erasing cookies pretty simple. You just select Options or Preferences and then choose Erase Cookies. And many personalized ad networks are offering consumers the option to opt out. I'm posting an updated and more detailed list of places to opt out on the website for this book, www.thefilterbubble.com. But because personalization is more or less unavoidable, opting out entirely isn't a particularly viable route for most of us. You can run all of your online activities in an incognito window where less of your personal information is stored, but it'll be increasingly impractical. Many services simply won't work the way they're supposed to. This is why, as I'll describe in a moment, I don't think the Do Not Track list currently under consideration by the FTC is a viable strategy. And, of course, Google personalizes based on your internet address, location, and a number of other factors, even if you're entirely logged out and on a brand new laptop. A better approach is to choose to use sites that give users more control and visibility over how their filters work and how they use your personal information. For example, consider the difference between Twitter and Facebook. In many ways, the two sites are very similar. They both offer people the opportunity to share blips of information and links to videos, news, and photographs. They both offer the opportunity to hear from the people you want to hear from and screen out the people you don't. But Twitter's universe is based on a few very simple, mostly transparent rules, what one Twitter supporter called a thin layer of regulation. Unless you go out of your way to lock your account, everything you do is public to everyone. You can subscribe to anyone's feed that you like without their permission, and then you see a time-ordered stream of updates that includes everything everyone you're following says. In comparison, the rules that govern Facebook's information universe are maddeningly opaque and seem to change almost daily. If you post a status update, your friends may or may not see it, and you may or may not see theirs. This is true even in the most recent view that many users assume shows all of the updates. It doesn't. Different types of content are likely to show up at different rates. If you post a video, for example, it's more likely to be seen by your friends than a status update. And the information you share with the site itself is private one day and public the next. There's no excuse, for example, for asking users to declare which websites they're fans of with the promise that it'll be shown only to their friends, and then releasing that information to the world, as Facebook did in 2009. Because Twitter operates on the basis of a few simple, easily understandable rules, it's also less susceptible to what venture capitalist Brad Burnham, whose Union Square Ventures was Twitter's primary early investor, calls the tyranny of the default. There's great power in setting the default option when people are given a choice. Dan Ariely, the behavioral economist, illustrates the principle with a chart showing organ donation rates in different European countries. In England, the Netherlands, and Austria, the rates hover around 10% to 15%, but in France, Germany, and Belgium, donation rates are in the high 90s. Why? In the first set of countries, you have to check a box giving permission for your organs to be donated. In the second, you have to check a box to say you won't give permission. If people will let defaults determine the fate of our friends who need lungs and hearts, we'll certainly let them determine how we share information a lot of the time. That's not because we're stupid. It's because we're busy, have limited attention with which to make decisions, and generally trust that if everyone else is doing something, it's okay for us to do it too. But this trust is often misplaced. Facebook has wielded this power with great intentionality, shifting the defaults on privacy settings in order to encourage masses of people to make their posts more public. And because software architects clearly understand the power of the default and use it to make their services more profitable, their claim that users can opt out of giving their personal information seems somewhat disingenuous. With fewer rules and a more transparent system, there are fewer defaults to set. Facebook's PR department didn't return my emails requesting an interview, perhaps because MoveOn's critical view of Facebook's privacy practices is well known. But it would probably argue that it gives its users far more choice and control about how they use the service than Twitter does. And it's true that Facebook's options control panel lists scores of different options for Facebook users. But to give people control, you have to make clearly evident what the options are, because options largely exist only to the degree that they're perceived. This is the problem many of us used to face in programming our VCRs. The devices had all sorts of functions, but figuring out how to make them do anything was an afternoon-long exercise in frustration. When it comes to important tasks like protecting your privacy and adjusting your filters online, saying that you can figure it out if you read the manual for long enough isn't a sufficient answer. In short, at the time of this writing, Twitter makes it pretty straightforward to manage your filter and understand what's showing up and why, whereas Facebook makes it nearly impossible. All other things being equal, if you're concerned about having control over your filter bubble, better to use services like Twitter than services like Facebook. We live in an increasingly algorithmic society, where our public functions, from police databases to energy grids to schools, run on code. We need to recognize that societal values about justice, freedom, and opportunity are embedded in how code is written and what it solves for. Once we understand that, we can begin to figure out which variables we care about and imagine how we might solve for something different. For example, advocates looking to solve the problem of political gerrymandering, the backroom process of carving up electoral districts to favor one party or another, have long suggested that we replace the politicians involved with software. It sounds pretty good. Start with some basic principles, input population data, and out pops a new political map. But it doesn't necessarily solve the basic problem, because what the algorithm solves for has political consequences. Whether the software aims to group by cities or ethnic groups or natural boundaries can determine which party keeps its seats in Congress and which doesn't. And if the public doesn't pay close attention to what the algorithm is doing, it could have the opposite of the intended effect, sanctioning a partisan deal with the imprimatur of neutral code. In other words, it's becoming more important to develop a basic level of algorithmic literacy. Increasingly, citizens will have to pass judgment on programmed systems that affect our public and national life. And even if you're not fluent enough to read through thousands of lines of code, the building block concepts, how to wrangle variables, loops, and memory, can illuminate how these systems work and where they might make errors. Especially at the beginning, learning the basics of programming is even more rewarding than learning a foreign language. With a few hours and a basic platform, you can have that hello world experience and start to see your ideas come alive. And within a few weeks, you can be sharing these ideas with the whole web. Mastery, as in any profession, takes much longer, but the payoff for a limited investment in coding is fairly large. It doesn't take long to become literate enough to understand what most basic bits of code are doing. Changing our own behavior is a part of the process of bursting the filter bubble, but it's of limited use unless the companies that are propelling personalization forward change as well. What companies can do. It's understandable that, given their meteoric rises, the Googles and Facebooks of the online world have been slow to realize their responsibilities, but it's critical that they recognize their public responsibility soon. It's no longer sufficient to say that the personalized internet is just a function of relevance-seeking machines doing their job. The new filterers can start by making their filtering systems more transparent to the public, so that it's possible to have a discussion about how they're exercising their responsibilities in the first place. As Larry Lessig says, a political response is possible only when regulation is transparent. And there's more than a little irony in the fact that companies whose public ideologies revolve around openness and transparency are so opaque themselves. Facebook, Google, and their filtering brethren claim that to reveal anything about their algorithmic processes would be to give away business secrets. But that defense is less convincing than it sounds at first. Both companies' primary advantage lies in the extraordinary number of people who trust them and use their services. Remember lock-in? According to Danny Sullivan's Search Engine Land blog, Bing's search results are highly competitive with Google's, but it has a fraction of its more powerful rivals' users. It's not a matter of math that keeps Google ahead, but the sheer number of people who use it every day. PageRank and the other major pieces of Google's search engine are actually one of the world's worst-kept secrets, says Google fellow Amit Singhal. Google has also argued that it needs to keep its search algorithm under tight wraps, because if it was known, it'd be easier to game. But open systems are harder to game than closed ones, precisely because everyone shares an interest in closing loopholes. The open-source operating system Linux, for example, is actually more secure and harder to penetrate with a virus than closed ones like Microsoft's Windows or Apple's OS X. Whether or not it makes the filterer's products more secure or efficient, keeping the code under tight wraps does do one thing. It shields these companies from accountability for the decisions they're making because the decisions are difficult to see from the outside. But even if full transparency proves impossible, it's possible for these companies to shed more light on how they approach sorting and filtering problems. For one thing, Google and Facebook and other new media giants could draw inspiration from the history of newspaper ombudsmen, which became a newsroom topic in the mid-1960s. Philip Foisy, an executive at the Washington Post Company, wrote one of the most memorable memos arguing for the practice. "It is not enough to say," he suggested, "that our paper, as it appears each morning, is its own credo, that ultimately we are our own ombudsman. It has not proven to be, possibly cannot be. Even if it were, it would not be viewed as such. It is too much to ask the reader to believe that we are capable of being honest and objective about ourselves." The Post found his argument compelling and hired its first ombudsman in 1970. "We know the media is a great dichotomy," said the longtime Sacramento Bee ombudsman Arthur Nauman in a speech in 1994. "On the one hand," he said, "media has to operate as a successful business that provides a return on investment. But on the other hand, it is a public trust, a kind of public utility. It is an institution invested with enormous power in the community, the power to affect thoughts and actions by the way it covers the news, the power to hurt or help the common good. It is this spirit that the new media would do well to channel. Appointing an independent ombudsman and giving the world more insight into how the powerful filtering algorithms work would be an important first step." Transparency doesn't mean only that the guts of a system are available for public view. As the Twitter versus Facebook dichotomy demonstrates, it also means that individual users intuitively understand how the system works. And that's a necessary precondition for people to control and use these tools, rather than having the tools control and use us. To start with, we ought to be able to get a better sense of who these sites think we are. Google claims to make this possible with a dashboard, a single place to monitor and manage all of this data. In practice, its confusing and multi-tiered design makes it almost impossible for an average user to navigate and understand. Facebook, Amazon, and other companies don't allow users to download a complete compilation of their data in the United States, though privacy laws in Europe force them to. It's an entirely reasonable expectation that data that users provide to companies ought to be available to us, and that this expectation is one that, according to University of California at Berkeley, most Americans share. We ought to be able to say, "You're wrong. Perhaps I used to be a surfer, or a fan of comics, or a Democrat, but I'm not anymore." Knowing what information the personalizers have on us isn't enough. They also need to do a much better job explaining how they use the data, what bits of information are personalized, to what degree, and on what basis. A visitor to a personalized news site could be given the option of seeing how many other visitors were seeing which articles, even perhaps a color-coded visual map of the areas of commonality and divergence. Of course, this requires admitting to the user that personalization is happening in the first place, and there are strong reasons in some cases for businesses not to do so. But they're mostly commercial reasons, not ethical ones. The Interactive Advertising Bureau is already pushing in this direction. An industry trade group for the online advertising community, the IAB, has concluded that unless personalized ads disclose to users how they're personalized, consumers will get angry and demand federal regulation. So it's encouraging its members to include a set of icons on every ad to indicate what personal data the ad draws on, and how to change or opt out of this feature set. As content providers incorporate the personalization techniques pioneered by direct marketers and advertisers, they should consider incorporating these safeguards as well. Even then, sunlight doesn't solve the problem unless it's coupled with a focus in these companies on optimizing for different variables: more serendipity, more humanistic and nuanced sense of identity, and an active promotion of public issues and cultivation of citizenship. As long as computers lack consciousness, empathy, and intelligence, much will be lost in the gap between our actual selves and the signals that can be rendered into personalized environments. And as I discussed in Chapter 5, personalization algorithms can cause identity loops, in which what the code knows about you constructs your media environment, and your media environment helps to shape your future preferences. This is an avoidable problem, but it requires crafting an algorithm that prioritizes falsifiability, that is, an algorithm that aims to disprove its idea of who you are. If Amazon harbors a hunch that you're a crime novel reader, for example, it could actively present you with choices from other genres to fill out its sense of who you are. Companies that hold great curatorial power also need to do more to cultivate public space and citizenship. To be fair, they're already doing some of this. Visitors to Facebook on November 2, 2010 were greeted by a banner asking them to indicate if they'd voted. Those who had voted shared this news with their friends. Because some people vote because of social pressure, it's quite possible that Facebook increased the number of voters. Likewise, Google has been doing strong work to make information about polling locations more open and easily available, and featured its tool on its homepage on the same day. Whether or not this is a profit-seeking behavior, a Find Your Polling Place feature would presumably be a terrific place for political advertising. Both projects drew the attention of users toward political engagement and citizenship. A number of the engineers and technology journalists I talked to raised their eyebrows when I asked them if personalizing algorithms could do a better job on this front. After all, one said, who's to say what's important? For Google engineers to place a value on some kinds of information over others, another suggested, would be unethical, though of course this is precisely what the engineers themselves do all the time. To be clear, I don't yearn to go back to the good old days when a small group of all-powerful editors unilaterally decided what was important. Too many actually important stories, the genocide in Rwanda, for example, fell through the cracks, while too many actually unimportant ones got front-page coverage. But I also don't think we should jettison that approach altogether. Yahoo News suggests there is some possibility for middle ground. The team combines algorithmic personalization with old-school editorial leadership. Some stories are visible to everyone because they're surpassingly important. Others show up for some users and not others. And while the editorial team at Yahoo spends a lot of time interpreting click data and watching which articles do well and which don't, they're not subservient to it. Our editors think of the audience as people with interests as opposed to a flood of directional data, a Yahoo News employee told me. As much as we love the data, it's being filtered by human beings who are thinking about what the heck it means. Why didn't the article on this topic we think is important for our readers to know about do better? How do we help it find a larger audience? And then there are fully algorithmic solutions. For example, why not rely on everyone's idea of what's important? Imagine for a moment that next to each like button on Facebook was an important button. You could tag items with one or the other, or both, and Facebook could draw on a mix of both signals, what people like and what they think really matters, to populate and personalize your newsfeed. You'd have to bet that news about Pakistan would be seen more often, even accounting for everyone's quite subjective definition of what really matters. Collaborative filtering doesn't have to lead to compulsive media. The whole game is in what values the filters seek to pull out. Alternately, Google or Facebook could place a slider bar running from only stuff I like to stuff other people like that I'll probably hate at the top of search results and the newsfeed, allowing users to set their own balance between tight personalization and a more diverse information flow. This approach would have two benefits. It would make clear that there's personalization going on, and it would place it more firmly in the user's control. There's one more thing the engineers of the filter bubble can do. They can solve for serendipity by designing filtering systems to expose people to topics outside their normal experience. This will often be in tension with pure optimization in the short term, because a personalization system with an element of randomness will, by definition, get fewer clicks. But as the problems of personalization become better known, it may be a good move in the long run. Consumers may choose systems that are good at introducing them to new topics. Perhaps what we need is a kind of anti-Netflix prize, a serendipity prize for systems that are the best at holding readers' attention while introducing them to new topics and ideas. If this shift toward corporate responsibility seems improbable, it's not without precedent. In the mid-1800s, printing a newspaper was hardly a reputable business. Papers were fiercely partisan and recklessly ideological. They routinely altered facts to suit their owners' vendettas of the day, or just to add color. It was this culture of crass commercialism and manipulation that Walter Lippmann railed against in Liberty and the News. But as newspapers became highly profitable and highly important, they began to change. It became possible in a few big cities to run papers that weren't just chasing scandal and sensation, in part because their owners could afford not to. Courts started to recognize a public interest in journalism and rule accordingly. Consumers started to demand more scrupulous and rigorous editing. Urged on by Lippmann's writings, an editorial ethic began to take shape. It was never shared universally or followed as well as it could have been. It was always compromised by the business demands of newspapers' owners and shareholders. It failed outright repeatedly. Access to power brokers compromised truth-telling, and the demands of advertisers overcame the demands of readers. But, in the end, it succeeded, somehow, in seeing us through a century of turmoil. The torch is now being passed to a new generation of curators, and we need them to pick it up and carry it with pride. We need programmers who will build public life and citizenship into the worlds they create, and we need users who will hold them to it when the pressures of monetization pulls them in a different direction. What governments and citizens can do. There's plenty that the companies that power the filter bubble can do to mitigate the negative consequences of personalization. The ideas just discussed are just a start. But ultimately, some of these problems are too important to leave in the hands of private actors with profit-seeking motives. That's where governments come in. Ultimately, as Eric Schmidt told Stephen Colbert, Google is just a company. Even if there are ways of addressing these issues that don't hurt the bottom line, which there may well be, doing so simply isn't always going to be a top-level priority. As a result, after we've each done our part to pop the filter bubble, and after companies have done what they're willing to do, there's probably a need for government oversight to ensure that we control our online tools and not the other way around. In his book, Republic.com, Cass Sunstein suggested a kind of fairness doctrine for the Internet, in which information aggregators have to expose their audiences to both sides. Though he later changed his mind, the proposal suggests one direction for regulation. Just require curators to behave in a public-oriented way, exposing their readers to diverse lines of argument. I'm skeptical, for some of the same reasons Sunstein abandoned the idea. Curation is a nuanced, dynamic thing, an art as much as a science, and it's hard to imagine how regulating editorial ethics wouldn't inhibit a great deal of experimentation, stylistic diversity, and growth. As this book goes to press, the U.S. Federal Trade Commission is proposing a Do Not Track list modeled after the highly successful Do Not Call list. At first blush, it sounds pretty good. It would set up a single place to opt out of the online tracking that fuels personalization. But Do Not Track would probably offer a binary choice. Either you're in or you're out, and services that make money on tracking might simply disable themselves for Do Not Track list members. If most of the Internet goes dark for these people, they'll quickly leave the list. And as a result, the process could backfire, proving that people don't care about tracking, when in fact, what most of us want is more nuanced ways of asserting control. The best leverage point, in my view, is in requiring companies to give us real control over our personal information. Ironically, although online personalization is relatively new, the principles that ought to support this leverage have been clear for decades. In 1973, the Department of Housing, Education, and Welfare, under Nixon, recommended that regulations center on what it called fair information practices. You should know who has your personal data, what data they have, and how it's used. You should be able to prevent information collected about you for one purpose from being used for others. You should be able to correct inaccurate information about you. Your data should be secure. Nearly 40 years later, the principles are still basically right, and we're still waiting for them to be enforced. We can't wait much longer. In a society with an increasing number of knowledge workers, our personal data and personal brand are worth more than they ever have been. Especially if you're a blogger or a writer, if you make funny videos or music, or if you coach or consult for a living, your online data trail is one of your most valuable assets. But while it's illegal to use Brad Pitt's image to sell a watch without his permission, Facebook is free to use your name to sell one to your friends. In courts around the world, information brokers are pushing this view. Everyone's better off if your online life is owned by us. They argue that the opportunities and control that consumers get by using their free tools outweigh the value of their personal data. But consumers are entirely unequipped to make this calculation. While the control you gain is obvious, the control you lose, because, say, your personal data is used to deny you an opportunity down the road, is invisible. The asymmetry of understanding is vast. To make matters worse, even if you carefully read a company's privacy policy and decide that giving over rights to your personal information is worth it under those conditions, most companies reserve the right to change the rules of the game at any time. Facebook, for example, promised its users that if they made a connection with a page, that information would only be shared with their friends. But in 2010, it decided that all of that data should be made fully public, a clause in Facebook's privacy policy, as with many corporate privacy policies, allows it to change the rules retroactively. In effect, this gives them nearly unlimited power to dispatch personal data as they see fit. To enforce fair information practices, we need to start thinking of personal data as a kind of personal property and protecting our rights in it. Personalization is based on an economic transaction in which consumers are at an inherent disadvantage. While Google may know how much your race is worth to Google, you don't. And while the benefits are obvious, free email, the drawbacks, opportunities, and content missed, are invisible. Thinking of personal information as a form of property would help make this a fairer market. Although personal information is property, it's a special kind of property, because you still have a vested interest in your own data long after it's been exposed. You probably wouldn't want consumers to be able to sell all of their personal data in perpetuity. France's moral laws, in which artists retain some control over what's done with the piece after it's been sold, might be a better template. Speaking of France, while European laws are much closer to fair information practices in protecting personal information, by many accounts, the enforcement is much worse, partly because it's much harder for individuals to sue for breaches of the laws. Mark Rotenberg, executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, says, "We shouldn't have to accept as a starting point that we can't have free services on the Internet without major privacy violations. And this isn't just about privacy. It's also about how our data shapes the content and opportunities we see and don't see. And it's about being able to track and manage this constellation of data that represents our lives with the same ease that companies like Axiom and Facebook already do." Silicon Valley technologists sometimes portray this as an unwinnable fight. People have lost control of their personal data, they'll never regain it, and they just have to grow up and live with it. But legal requirements on personal information need not be foolproof in order to work, any more than legal requirements not to steal are useless because people sometimes still steal things and get away with it. The force of law adds friction to the transmission of some kinds of information, and in many cases, a little friction changes a lot. And there are laws that do protect personal information even in this day and age. The Fair Credit Reporting Act, for example, ensures that credit agencies have to disclose their credit reports to consumers and notify consumers when they're discriminated against on the basis of reports. That's not much, but given that previously consumers couldn't even see if their credit report contained errors, and 70% do, according to USPIRG, it's a step in the right direction. A bigger step would be putting in place an agency to oversee the use of personal information. The EU and most other industrial nations have this kind of oversight, but the United States has lingered behind, scattering responsibilities for protecting personal information among the Federal Trade Commission, the Commerce Department, and other agencies. As we enter the second decade of the 21st century, it's past time to take this concern seriously. None of this is easy. Private data is a moving target, and the process of balancing consumers' and citizens' interests against those of these companies will take a lot of fine-tuning. At worst, new laws could be more onerous than the practices they seek to prevent. But that's an argument for doing this right and doing it soon, before the companies who profit from private information have even greater incentives to try to block it from passing. Given the money to be made and the power that money holds over the American legislative system, this shift won't be easy. So to rescue our digital environment from itself, we'll ultimately need a new constituency of digital environmentalists, citizens of this new space we're all building, who band together to protect what's great about it. In the next few years, the rules that will govern the next decade or more of online life will be written, and the big online conglomerates are lining up to help write them. The communications giants who own the Internet's physical infrastructure have plenty of political clout. AT&T outranks oil companies and pharmaceutical companies as one of the top four corporate contributors to American politics. Intermediaries like Google get the importance of political influence too. Eric Schmidt is a frequent White House visitor, and companies like Microsoft, Google, and Yahoo have spent millions on influence mongering in Washington, D.C. Given all of the Web 2.0 hype about empowerment, it's ironic that the old adage still applies. In the fight for control of the Internet, everyone's organized but the people. But that's only because most of us aren't in the fight. People who use the Internet and are invested in its future outnumber corporate lobbyists by orders of magnitude. There are literally hundreds of millions of us across all demographics, political, ethnic, socioeconomic, and generational, who have a personal stake in the outcome. And there are plenty of smaller online enterprises that have every interest in ensuring a democratic, public-spirited web. If the great mass of us decide that an open, public-spirited Internet matters and speak up about it, if we join organizations like Free Press, a nonpartisan grassroots lobby for media reform, and make phone calls to Congress and ask questions at town hall meetings and contribute donations to the representatives who are leading the way, the lobbyists don't stand a chance. As billions come online in India and Brazil and Africa, the Internet is transforming into a truly global place. Increasingly, it will be the place where we live our lives. But in the end, a small group of American companies may unilaterally dictate how billions of people work, play, communicate, and understand the world. Protecting the early vision of radical connectedness and user control should be an urgent priority for all of us. This concludes the filter bubble. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers, or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog.